The markets react as the debt clock winds down.
Or is it winding down? From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith, in for Jeremy Hobson. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. Today is Tuesday, July 26th.
Coming up, we might be resetting the debt ceiling countdown clock. And wait a minute, what exactly is the debt ceiling anyway? We've got an explainer for you coming up.
Also, why global investors are in a Zurich state of mind.
And big doings at the FDIC a little later on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
President Obama and House Speaker John Boehner took to the airwaves last night. Did you see that, Steve?
I saw the dueling Washington speeches last night, yeah.
I know. They both made their respective cases in the debt ceiling debate. Both men did agree on one thing, though, that something has to be done by August 2nd. That's when the U.S. Treasury says the debt clock runs down. But Marketplace's Heidi Moore says it might be time to reset those clocks.
The debt ceiling debate has been going on endlessly for nearly a year. And with the end in sight on August 2nd, what's one more week?
You can still go beyond August 2nd. I think that's put out there as this D-Day, this deadline day. But it's not really.
That's Jeff Cleveland, an economist with Payden & Riegel. He says we have wiggle room, and he's right. Barclays, the investment bank, said today we may have as long as August 10th to raise the debt ceiling. That's because we got more tax revenues in July than we thought. $11 billion, to be exact. So now we're practically rolling in dough, right? Well, not exactly. Everyone's worried the U.S. will default when we don't have enough money to pay the interest we owe on our debt. The Treasury still has to pay that off, and the tax revenues won't help. We owe $30 billion in interest.
It's not until you get to that August 15th point where you have to make that payment. That's a large chunk of money.
It's a doozy, but it's nothing compared to the prospect of two more weeks of Washington sniping and speeches. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
Okay, so let's take a step back for a minute, Stacey, shall we?
Okay, let's do it.
Many people around the world do not understand what a debt ceiling is, let alone why the U.S. has one. But is the American debt limit really all that unique? Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us now with the latest on that. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
Is the U.S. the only developed country with a debt ceiling?
According to IHS Global Insight, there is one other advanced country with a debt ceiling. Mm-hmm. That's Denmark. But their ceiling is so high, it's never a problem.
So they never have to raise it. All right. So how do other developed countries keep their debt under control?
Well, of course, some of them don't. But ultimately, the markets decide, investors decide whether a country is trying to borrow too much. They'll say these bonds are risky and demand a higher rate of interest. That's precisely what's happened in Europe over the past 18 months. Greece, for example, has seen some of its interest rates driven up to 24-25%. The government in Athens couldn't afford that and so had to be bailed out.
So, Stephen, how is it that the U.S. built in this debt ceiling when no one else did?
Well, it's part of the web of checks and balances in the U.S. system. Does it need a ceiling? Well, the U.S. is unique with the biggest and richest economy. The global financial system needs U.S. dollars and U.S. Government bonds to function. That means there's always a pretty big demand for U.S. dollars and bonds. And that means that investors don't punish the U.S. for high levels of debt. The U.S. can keep its interest rates fairly low. Because of this, some analysts argue that the debt ceiling is a good tripwire, an early warning system. Here's Steve Barrow, currency strategist at Standard Bank.
Without that process, the U.S. may just rack up too much debt and the markets may not punish it sufficiently until one day the market finally snaps and suddenly U.S. interest rates move dramatically higher.
When the euro was launched a decade ago, there were some debt limits for member countries, but they were widely flouted. Now, after all the market mayhem of the past 18 months, there are some here saying what the euro needs is a debt ceiling.
Mm. All right. Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Stephen, thank you.
Okay, Steve.
Hey, you can check out the numbers any time of the day, how the stock markets are doing, and, of course, get the podcast every day at our website, marketplace.org.
However the debt ceiling debacle gets resolved, there is no question it's taken some of the shine off the dollar as an investment. And that's got currency investors pouring money into the Swiss franc. The BBC's Imogen Folks has more.
Switzerland may be a small country, population just short of 8 million, but it's also traditionally a very stable one. The franc has risen 30% against the dollar over the last year. Foreign exchange specialist Richard Driver from Caxton FX says traders see the franc as the safest bet around.
The appeal of the dollar and the yen is really taking a downturn, and the Swiss franc is the obvious alternative to those two, and to those investors who want to keep money in Europe but don't want to go for the euro, because there's a genuine chance of a total collapse in the eurozone.
But a strong currency has its downside. Switzerland's tourism industry is suffering. Foreign visitors are staying away, while the Swiss are neglecting their own resorts in favour of cheap holidays abroad. In Switzerland, I'm the BBC's Imogen Folks for Marketplace.
McDonald's Happy Meals are getting healthier, Steve.
Sounds good right about now.
I know. They're adding fruit and they're cutting back on fries.
Well, then I don't know.
I know. It's going to mean a 20% drop in happiness, in calories for the kids.
So calories equal happiness.
I don't know if they do for everybody. I find that they tend to for me. There's a pretty good calorie to happiness ratio going on for me.
Well, today the Senate Banking Committee, Stacey, holds a confirmation hearing for the top spot at the FDIC. I don't know if they're serving fries in Washington today. The agency,
they could probably use some fries.
They probably
today.
Could to sort of loosen things up a little bit. The agency that insures deposits and cleans up failed banks. Now, supporters of financial reform say the FDIC needs a permanent chairman soon so it can carry out the new Dodd-Frank law. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
Under Dodd-Frank, big banks have to file living wills, with the FDIC specifying how they can be wound down if they fail. The agency decides how much money banks have to keep in reserve. President Obama has nominated Martin Gruenberg to head the agency. Fred Rivera is an attorney and expert on the financial reform law.
So I think it's very important that someone gets confirmed, and it's somebody who carries respect within the industry to have these various regulations move forward and be effective.
Former FDIC Chair Sheila Bair had a similar warning this month. She said any delay in confirming her successor would make it hard for the FDIC to assert its authority under Dodd-Frank. Bill Black teaches economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He says Bair was a strong reformer.
Her opponents are eager to prevent or at least delay this nomination.
But the nominee, Gruenberg, is already the FDIC's vice chairman. Black says that could speed things up. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Well, as a kid, I was reading encyclopedias when everyone else my age was playing Pac-Man.
I love that.
I was such a geek.
You wanted facts. That's not geeky.
I did.
That's awesome.
I was a reference book child. So in an effort, Stacey, to escape the whole debt ceiling debate in Washington, what did I do? I picked up a book. It's called The Real State of America Atlas, that lays out how the rest of the country is doing economically, like state-by-state comparisons of personal bankruptcies and the number of people per capita in poverty, under the poverty line, things like that. Cynthia Enloe co-wrote the book that is out today, and she's with us now. Good morning, Cynthia.
Good morning.
Let's map the American economy as it is, say, in your book. What does that map look like?
It really does matter in this country where you live. And even within regions, there's such diversity of economic conditions, so that if you live in the South, you can live in a lot of different economic conditions. So, for instance, in terms of personal bankruptcies, South Carolina has one of the lowest levels, mm-hmm. but right next door is Georgia that has one of the highest.
That's interesting. And there are many states that actually compare to big countries as far as their economies go, right?
That's certainly true. Today, the economy of California matches that of Brazil. And remember, Brazil is one of the great emerging tigers, if you will. And even little Vermont has an economy that is the size of Jordan.
I know the deficit and the debt ceiling debate have been sort of taking center stage. When you look at the big picture, how do our perceptions of government spending differ from reality?
Well, I think one of the stunning maps that we have shows states in terms of how much each state per capita receive from the federal government. One would think that some of the, if you will, reddest states would be the ones that don't get much from the federal government. Mm-hmm. But in fact, Alaska is number one. and Virginia, New Mexico, Kansas, North Dakota are all way up there. So I think that when you map the United States, it really can change the public conversation.
What were some of the most surprising facts you came across as you mapped all this information?
We're all interested in consumer products, right? So here's one of my favorite factoids. The little Mediterranean country of Malta, mm-hmm. per capita, drinks more Coca-Cola than any other people in the world.
No, I would never have thought Malta.
If you're a dentist in Malta, you probably are doing good business, too.
Cynthia Enloe co-wrote the Real State of America Atlas, and I thank you so much. Interesting conversation.
Thanks an awful lot, Steve.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
So, Steve, do you have a cell phone? I assume you do.
Of course I do, yes.
And I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but there tend to be a lot of fees on those bills.
I mean,
with strange
all kinds
names,
of
right?
fees, absolutely.
All right, well, I have some schadenfreude for you this morning.
Right.
You're going to love this. Los Angeles, where you are,
yeah.
is suing AT&T for not paying a fee, essentially, for failing
really?
To pay nearly $5 million for something called the communications user tax.
Wow.
Doesn't that sound like something that is on your cell phone
it
bill?
It sounds like something, yeah, it's one of those like, yeah, that it normally would charge me like 14 cents a month or something like that.
Yeah. I know. And I was actually, speaking of 14, you know, calling in to complain about those fees, I was thinking that we're not quite even with AT&T, even though they do have $5 million. But I think if AT&T has to sit on the phone for a few hours trying to figure out what the tax actually is, then maybe we can think about calling it even.
Maybe they'll call LA sometime today and they'll say, hey, what's going on with this? And they'll put them on hold.
Exactly. Arizona actually is planning to try to save $500 million right now by cutting the number of people getting health care through Medicaid. Paul Atkinson has that story.
Arizona sent out 250,000 notices this month explaining the change to its Medicaid program. The state is not cutting coverage, it's freezing enrollment for a population most states don't cover, childless adults. So if recipients become ineligible because their earnings exceed the income threshold, they can't renew their policy. The state's Medicaid director, Tom Betlock, says he expects 100,000 childless adults will lose coverage in the first year.
We obviously regret that we have to make these decisions as well, but they are decisions that have to be made because of the economic circumstances we're going through here in the state of Arizona.
Arizona voters approved expanding Medicaid eligibility in 2000. Money from the state's tobacco settlement initially covered the additional cost. But now, with 1 in 5 Arizonans receiving Medicaid, the state is having to chip in. This year, fully 12% of its budget. At the same time, the state is trying to recover from an historic drop in revenue triggered by the financial crisis.
So with the general fund losing about a third of its revenue stream and the fact that the program grew by 300,000 members during the first couple of years of the recession, those types of fiscal pressures really became unmanageable and unsustainable for the state.
But critics of Arizona's Medicaid cutbacks think policymakers overreacted. Because of the cuts, the state will lose $1 billion in federal matching funds. And there will be indirect costs, says Eddie Sissons of the Arizona Foundation for Behavioral Health.
So, you know, whenever I come in with my kid who's broken her arm, or I come in with, you know, a really allergic reaction for a bee sting, which I'm allergic to, I'm going to just wait longer because the emergency rooms are going to be crowded.
Sissons and others warn all Arizonans will pay higher health care costs as hospitals raise everyone else's rates to cover former Medicaid patients. In Phoenix, I'm Paul Atkinson for Marketplace.
Join us tomorrow. Paul will tell us about a couple who's just about to lose their Medicaid coverage.
All right. Finally, Stacey, a group of English villagers wanted to break a world record and create the world's smallest pub. So they started pouring pints for patrons in one of those red London telephone booths. You've seen those, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm thinking this thing is probably no more than 3 or 4 square feet.
But it's like the size of most New York apartments.
Exactly, yes, in what you would call in New York spacious. So, alas, though, the bar did not have a license to pour those pints. So the current record stands, the smallest permanent licensed bar in the world, this is how Guinness classifies this, is still the 91-square-foot pub in Switzerland, known simply as the smallest whiskey bar on earth.
Wow, I wonder if they have a four-square check in there. That would be, right?
That's right. Hello, I'm at the smallest whiskey bar on earth.
I mean, that would be an interesting check-in.
That's great.
And speaking of four-square, you can find Steve and I both on Twitter. The program is at Marketplace Radio. My Twitter address is at S. Vanek Smith.
And I'm at Radio Chio in Los Angeles. I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And in New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.